Hello. An hour. This time dedicated to the monumental piece, Akedah, Sacrifice, by the Israeli composer, Ari Shapira. Sacrifice, written in 1981 to 1982, was a joint commission by the Israel Museum, the Jerusalem Theater, and the Israel Festival. But this piece was never performed. It had laid in wait for more than 27 years, and was finally performed only a few months ago as part of the Israeli music holidays in Israel. My accounts today regarding Akedah will be based on an informal conversation that I had with the composer in his home in Haifa earlier in January this year. I have already in the past dedicated a double program to the recent pieces of Shapira, one of Israel's foremost composers, and by all means, for many, the voice of the Israeli avant-garde. Shapira presents us with his Akedah, a setting to music of the two biblical texts from the book of Genesis, amongst which is the story of the sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham, or I should say the intended sacrifice, giving this piece its title, but also a text in the third movement relating to the Holocaust, and more specifically to the Jewish Czech composer who found his death, like many others, in the hands of the Nazis, Gideon Klein. The fourth movement presents us with texts borrowed from Israeli cultural life at large, and the fifth and last movement with text borrowed from David Ben-Gurion's speeches. David Ben-Gurion, for those of you who need some kind of clarification, was the first prime minister of Israel, and considered today almost a mythical character in the Israeli consciousness. Shapira, in fact, uses these extra musical stimuli in order to reconstruct for us the way he sees the narrative of the Israeli society. For those of you who are familiar with Shapira's compositions, this subject matter should not come as any surprise. Shapira has by now branded himself as one of the only Israeli composers to publicly come out against the Israeli occupation of the territories, and is in fact one of the most critical voices of his generation in Israeli classical music when it comes to many of the sacred cows of the Israeli narrative. Many of Shapira's electronic pieces, all of which include text, are anti-war statements. Pieces such as Left-Right about the First Lebanon War of 1982, upon Die Ruins of Fra, which was so political for its time that it was actually banned from performance on Israeli public radio, but of course played here on Chalas in the shows I dedicated to Shapira in the past. Or a piece like Ilabi Ilabi, using the lyrics and melody of a famous Zionist song, whilst translating the text into Arabic and using an orchestration reminiscent of more traditional Arab music. The same is true for the topic of the Holocaust. Shapira is very critical not only of the German treatment of this subject, but also of the treatment, and musical treatment I should say, it receives in Israel. Shapira recounted to me in the past that pieces regarding the Holocaust should either contain texts in German or Yiddish, the language spoken by the Ashkenazi Jews of Europe. Hebrew, Shapira claims, is not part of this narrative. Hebrew comes only later, historically, and has to do with earlier or later crimes, as you will soon see portrayed in the piece before us today. Yiddish, on the other hand, is used in a piece such as Gustl und Theresienstadt, a portrayal of an imaginary scenario in which the composer Gustav Mahler would have shared the fate of other composers, such as Viktor Ullmann, or indeed Gideon Klein, and would have been deported to the quote-unquote artist concentration camp, Theresienstadt. Another piece with subject matter relating to the Holocaust, entitled Letzte Briefe aus Stalingrad, Last Letters from Stalingrad, is a macabre setting to music of some last letters sent by German soldiers who were to find their death in the turning point battles of the Second World War in Stalingrad. These pieces, Shapira claims, have an aesthetical value for all listeners, but are in fact intended for Germans. This, in the same manner that political pieces Shapira writes regarding Israel, share their aesthetics with all listeners, but are in fact intended for Israeli ears. So indeed, the piece we are about to listen to today is intended for Israeli ears. As Shapira sees it, only an Israeli, and possibly only an Israeli from the same generation as Shapira himself, could truly understand this piece. I will try nonetheless to go into the mind of such a person today and convey, to the best of my ability, what it is that Shapira intends to create in his piece, Sacrifice, Akedah. The most obvious facets for those acquainted with some of Shapira's music would be that in this piece there is a complete departure from Shapira's usual presentation of short, concise pieces, and stylistically very modernistic pieces. This is a 40-minute piece for large ensemble, including both traditional orchestral instruments, a rock ensemble, and live electronics. This is, in fact, Shapira's second longest piece after his electronic opera, The Costner Trial, but also a piece that acts and sounds like a true postmodern piece. So much so that on the first hearing, the first movement of the piece sounded like a piece of Louis Andriessen in my ears. This stylistic element is not diminished as the piece unfolds, but in fact becomes more and more evident. These stylistic decisions have much to do with the origins of the commission. As I stated before, the piece was commissioned by three very official Israeli bodies. It was in fact intended as a sort of showpiece for the donors of the Israel Museum, and initially commissioned as an audiovisual piece in collaboration with the sculptor and performance artist Moti Mizrahi. Shapira and Mizrahi together sojourned to Jerusalem in order to inspect the stage on which the piece was supposed to be performed, and the first thing that Shapira noticed were the many Israeli flags adorning the empty stage. Shapira commented to Mizrahi on how fascistic this seemed to him, and recounts that it was at this moment that he decided that the music in Akedah will be softer than his usual style. The idea was to flatter the ears of the donors, whilst creating a very subtly critical piece. I would like to add, a very brave piece. This is Shapira seeking the utmost musical means to complete, or almost mimic, the hypocrisy he sees in these chosen texts for Akedah. Finally, the cost for this planned production seemed too high, and the finished score of Akedah was neglected until its first performance 27 years later. Akedah opens with a text taken from Genesis 21. In fact, for those of you who would like to follow these texts whilst I go into explanations or analysis of the piece, I've posted a link on our info page. It's available by just clicking the info button on the page in front of you right now, and the text will be available in English. But anyway, Genesis 21 is the story of Hagar and Ishmael. As you might know, Abraham, the first monotheistic man, was married to Sarah. He also took a concubine in the form of Hagar, who was initially the Egyptian handmaid of Sarah. Sarah is not able to bear children, and it is with Hagar that Abraham has a child. This is Ishmael. In chapter 21 of Genesis, God, in his infinite grace and according to the promise he made to Abraham, gives the very old Sarah a child in the form of Isaac. Sarah, seeing older Ishmael mocking her at some point, asks Abraham to cast him and his mother out. Abraham, disturbed, is told by the Lord to oblige Sarah, and is promised that Ishmael, as is Isaac, will be the seed of a great nation. Abraham casts the two out into the desert, giving them bread and water. The bread and water are soon spent, of course, and Ishmael is close to death. His mother cries in despair, and the Lord, hearing her cry, intervenes in the form of a well. He promises Hagar that no harm will be brought upon the child, and that he will indeed, as promised, be the seed of a great nation one day. Ishmael is saved and grows older to become an archer. This is where the quoted text ends. Shapira has no use for the rest of chapter 21, as it contains no relevance to the point he tries to convey. And Shapira goes on immediately to the second movement, using the text from Genesis 22. This is the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. God, intending on testing Abraham's faith, commands him to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. Abraham, shattered by this news, obeys all the same and makes all preparations for the sacrifice to take place on Mount Moriah the day after. On their mutual journey up the mount, Isaac, thinking all along that his father and he are intending on sacrificing a lamb to God, asks his father where the lamb is. Abraham answers that God will provide them with one. This is, of course, bad news for Isaac, as he soon realizes he is the lamb. Yet just as Abraham raises his knife to kill his own son, an angel of God appears and stops him from doing so, saying that his faith had been proven. A lamb miraculously appears, and it is finally killed as sacrifice for the Lord. The angel appears once again and promises Abraham that his seed will be as numerous as the sands on the beach. Abraham and Isaac descend from the mount and go towards Beersheba. This too, not the end of chapter 22 of Genesis, but indeed where Shapira decides to cut it short, as the remaining part carries no real relevance to the story or to the narrative that Shapira is trying to relate to. The story of Hagar and Ishmael is treated by biblical scholars as the story of the birth of the Arab race. This is not only a scholarly approach that maintains this view, but this is in fact a popular view in Israel. It is, for instance, not uncommon to hear certain parts of the Israeli society, especially ultra-religious Jews or settlers, or both, referring to Arabs as Ishmaelites. In fact, a critical reading of the chapters in Genesis dealing with Ishmael would disclose many allusions made through Ishmael himself to Arabs or Muslims. Shapira makes use of this story and its evolution to make a political point regarding Israel's current situation with the Palestinians. Shapira is trying to make analogies between the outcasting of Hagar and Ishmael, the coldness in which this is done by Abraham, to the outcasting Israel has practiced, and in his eyes, still practicing with the Palestinians today. Not only this, but the biblical story of the outcasting is followed by one of the stories that has since become a mythical story, not only for the Jews as a faith, but for Israel as a culture. The story of the sacrifice has been referred to in prose and music by Israeli artists probably more than any other story in the Bible. Yet Shapira reads a paradox into this story. He says a mythical sacrifice is occurring in which not one drop of blood is shed, a story of absolute and almost blind adherence to the word of God, a metaphor to the law perhaps. Isaac, portrayed as a sacrifice, yet is he really? He himself is saved, and nothing really happens to him in his biblical story. Yet Ishmael is cast out and mentioned in passing only once more in Genesis. Isaac as a possible metaphor for the Israeli society, in one respect treating itself like the ultimate sacrifice vis-a-vis not only the Arabs, but also the Germans. Yet the biblical story, as Shapira claims, ends with absolutely no bloodshed. An analogy in Shapira's eyes, perhaps, to the Israeli perception of themselves, Israel as a constant victim, when in fact, like Isaac, they are not only saved, but disregarding the banishment of Ishmael. Ishmael, in this case, portraying the Palestinians, perhaps, as Shapira sees it. On a different level, Shapira sees Abraham, more than anything, as blindly obedient. Shapira recounts to me that this obedience brings to his mind one specific photo of Hungarian Jews standing in line for the gas chambers in Poland, as if completely accepting their fate. Shapira continues, and I quote, "Abraham is ordered, and he obeys. The Jews are an obedient nation," end quote. I will emphasize further connections Shapira makes between the biblical story of the sacrifice and that of the Holocaust, but first I would like to go into a deeper layer of the text reading, having to do with some of the musical choices Shapira has made in the actual piece. One will immediately notice that the first movement of Akedah, portraying the story of Hagar and Ishmael, is composed very laconically. The whole movement uses only one chord, orchestrated very sparsely, and introduces very short and almost pointillistic note lengths. Let's have a quick listen to the beginning of the first movement of Akedah. The acute listener could have possibly heard or noticed that the attack of each new chord sang by the choir is accented by the live electronics. The method used here by Shapira is a vocoderization. It's triggered by the choir's attacks, and on each new attack, it mixes a very short sample of pre-recorded brass parts taken from the first movement and the actual choir voices. This is done again in order to bring out a coldness or a preciseness in the music. The reason for this musical portrayal of the text lies within a personal and quite ingenious reading of Shapira's into the writing style of the biblical text. One will immediately notice that the story of Hagar and Ishmael is told in very short sentences, using an excessive amount of punctuation marks and very sparse on the details. It reminds me personally very much of a legal text, very precise, yet very cold. The story is chilling, however. After all, we are discussing the outcasting of a mother and her child, the latter almost dying, and his mother expressing enormous amounts of grief. Yet it is told as if with no involvement on behalf of the writer. The story of the sacrifice, however, exemplifies the exact opposite. Long sentences, less punctuation marks, more details, and a more literary approach towards the writing, as if trying to spotlight almost the drama in the story. I was asked by Shapira at the time whether I understood why the writers of the texts have decided to do so. I must admit that I couldn't answer this question. Yet according to Shapira, the idea was to completely brush off the story of the banishment, in the same sense, as he sees it, that Israel as a society today disregards or completely ignores its current banishment of the Palestinians. A problem that didn't start in 1967 with the occupation of the territories, or 1948 even, but in fact in biblical times, as Shapira sees it. On the other hand, the biblical writer is trying to portray as mythical the story of the sacrifice, with a very dramatic writing, connecting, as Shapira sees it, to the almost mythical approach that the Israeli society takes towards its own part in the historical sacrifice vis-a-vis the Germans and later, the Arabs. What I've just recounted, Shapira tries to portray musically in Akedah. The first movement, as I mentioned before, introduces very sparse writing. It tries to mimic almost the lack of drama in the written texts, and as if to paint musically the cynical treatment taken by the biblical writers when portraying the story of Hagar and Ishmael. At the end of the first movement, Shapira introduces a very noticeable musical change, orchestrated for the soloists and piano. This is, in fact, as you will soon realize, the musical material of the second movement. Let's listen to that moment at the end of movement one. As you will see, this is of course not a random decision. It is at the end of movement one that Shapira decides to introduce the text relating to the second movement, namely Genesis 22, or the story of the sacrifice. And this chapter in Genesis starts so. And it came to pass after these things that God did prove Abraham, and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And God said, Take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, even Isaac, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Now compare this to a passage from chapter 21 dealing with Hagar and Ishmael. And Abraham arose up early in the morning, and took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and the child, and sent her away. And she departed, and strayed in the wilderness of Beersheba. So I think it's very easy to notice that these two consecutive stories, these two consecutive chapters of Genesis, are told with a completely opposite sense of drama. The sacrifice starting with an ominous conversation between God and Abraham, which is in a way completely superfluous, but of course extenuates the drama. Also take a look at a passage such as, Take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, even Isaac. A repetition purely for dramatic sake, clearly. The story of Hagar and Ishmael's banishment, on the other hand, is almost technical in comparison. It states only the facts with almost no literary additions. And so does Shapira in the music. The minute the text of the sacrifice appears at the end of the first movement of Akedah, Shapira makes an extreme departure from the laconic musical style of the first movement and paints the biblical text of the sacrifice with his idea of a musical drama. The latter Shapira approaches in the same way that Bach would approach a biblical text as well, literally emphasizing important moments or words in the text so that these stick out. One will also notice that the choir from the first movement continues its musical material into the second movement as well, but suddenly its note lengths are longer, not as short or pointillistic, and its musical material much more varied and constantly disturbed by the new musical material, the dramatic material introduced at the end of the first movement. all of the mention added with pre-recorded percussion samples in the second movement. In Shapira's eyes, these percussion sounds serve no purpose other than beautification. Indeed, an approach that some composers might take with no special rhyme or reason, but not Shapira. And he takes this opportunity to make a mockery of the latter sort of composer as well. Not only is this a musical statement negating such composing of beautification for beautification's sake, but does also in Shapira's mind equate to the over-dramatization of the text he is suggesting to criticize. Let's listen to a snippet from the second movement. So in Ari Shapira's narrative of the Israeli society through his piece Akedah, we have now gone through the two first stages, let us call them original sin and hubris, if you will. But from this point, Shapira immediately jumps to what is seen as the most pivotal moment in Jewish history, and hence Israeli history. This is, of course, the Holocaust. The Holocaust is portrayed in Akedah in a very strange manner as far as the oeuvre of Shapira is concerned. Indeed, the third movement of Akedah is taken from a separate piece written by Shapira earlier in his career called Gideon Klein's Marterstrasse, or in English, Gideon Klein's Way of Grief, or in Italian, Via Dolorosa. The third movement of Akedah differs from the original piece only in orchestration, yet the form remains the same. The original orchestration, by the way, is for clarinet, violin, piano, and voice. But the interesting facet of this movement, and indeed the stylistic departure as far as Shapira is concerned, is in the musical content. This movement contains two very specific borrowed materials. The one, played as written by Beethoven on the piano, is the second movement of Beethoven's last piano sonata, number 32, opus 111. The second stimulus is the Bach chorale, as set for the St. John's Passion, Herzliebster Jesu, was hast du verbrochen? But in Shapira's rendition, this same chorale receives a new text. A text that at first might sound like German, but this is in fact Yiddish, and the text reads as following. Gideon Klein, spiel sich auf ein Piano. Fahr Gideon Klein, diese Marterstraße. Gideon Klein, play what on the piano? For Gideon Klein, this way of grief.
Thank you.
So as mentioned earlier, Shapira makes an immediate connection in his own writing between the Holocaust and German tradition. Hence, all of his pieces relating to the Holocaust are in some way a critique of German tradition. The quoting of these musical texts in the third movement of Akedah should not be taken in any way at face value. This is Shapira trying to mock German culture and focus on the abyss lying between this artistic culture that he quotes and, of course, its murderous outcome. Those familiar with Shapira's work also know that he always inserts some element of irony to his own pieces about the Holocaust. This can be heard in a piece I've mentioned earlier called Letzte Brief aus Stalingrad, Last Letters from Stalingrad, in which Shapira paints these texts in the least dramatic and deliberately non-traditional orchestration of five keyboard instruments, including piano, Hammond organ, Fender Rhodes, sampler, and harpsichord. This in order to avoid any drama when relating to these sometimes very difficult letters written by German soldiers at the front. But Shapira adds a special twist in the form of a very dramatic bass baritone voice that actually sings the texts. The voice, naturally dramatic, creates immediately an ironic negation to the five keyboard instruments and the musical materials they play. This can also be seen in Shapira's latest piece regarding the subject of the Holocaust. This is the Todesfuge, a death fugue, a setting to eight voices of the text by Paul Celan. Here, too, Shapira does not try to paint this very difficult text in any other color but sheer black. He only tries, as he usually does, to bring out the utter disgust of German culture the text tries to convey. Hence, Shapira is not painting the words, but only trying to convey the meaning of the text. Let us have a listen to this piece from 2008. If any of you are interested, an English translation by John Felsteiner is available by just clicking the info button on this page again. This recording that you're going to hear is a live recording from a concert given in Wannsee, Germany, in January 2009. So here it is for you, Todesfuge, Death Fugue for eight voices. The poem is by Paul Celan. Music, Ari Shapira. Todesfuge. Death Fugue. Paul Celan. Ari Shapira. So here again, we have a very dramatic Central European orchestration coupled with a musical material that immediately negates it, almost mocks it. This in the same manner that Celan, in his poem, tries to pinpoint the huge dichotomy between both sides of the German culture. Having listened to this piece, which is much more representative of Shapira's style, you will be able to better understand, I think, the stylistic departure made in the third movement of Akedah. Yet the usual irony is still there to be found in Akedah in the way that Shapira decides to deal with these borrowed musical materials, what he adds onto them, the text he adds to the original Bach chorale, and so on. I promised you before that I would also disclose a connection that Shapira makes between the biblical story of the sacrifice and the Holocaust. First, this is done musically. The second movement of Akedah is simply dotted with some quotes of musical material taken from Gideon Klein's Marterstrasse, the third movement of Akedah. So here for you is one of those moments. So the musical connection being made here by Shapira is quite clear, yet the question remains, what, in his eyes, is the connection? In my conversation with Shapira, he recounted to me that he sees the character of Isaac as a perfect representation of European Jewry. After all, Isaac, in the story of the sacrifice, is taken up the hill by his father, unknowing of the latter's intentions. Isaac, even though showing some elements of doubt in his question to his father regarding the whereabouts of the actual sacrificial lamb, continues towards his inevitable fate. Shapira feels that this is exactly the way that the Jews in Europe treated their own inevitable fate. Even though there were many signs of what was to come, it were as if the same European Jews kept on asking, and I quote Shapira here again, "Where is the sacrificial lamb? Where is the sacrifice? We are the sacrifice," said Shapira, and again recounted to me his perception of the Jews as an obedient nation. As he sees it, they had completely accepted their fate, first as victims of the Nazis, and again later, abiding a national narrative depicting them as victims of the Arab nations, or indeed the Palestinians. Thank you. The fourth movement of Akedah we've just heard a part of was actually only realized a few years ago. It was conceived in the early 80s when the score for the piece was written, but seeing there was never a performance, this electronic movement was never realized. A few years back, however, receiving indications that the piece might finally be picked up, Shapira started to realize this movement, and it was actually premiered on this program a year ago. The credits for Electronic Realization go to Guy Barash, and the singers are students from the music department of the Haifa University, where Shapira has been teaching for the past years. But why all of a sudden a tape movement played from speakers in the midst of an acoustic piece? Well, the answer lies in the subject matter for the last two movements of Akedah. Unlike the previous movements, the last two movements of Akedah are dealing with the present. This dealing with modern times translates immediately in Shapira's mind to composing with modern means. The idea for this movement came to Shapira based on a radio show of the 70s and 80s broadcast on Israeli National Radio. It was called Israeli Folk Dances. Shapira remembers that the music featured on this program was, and I quote, "a crazy music full of delirium." A multitude of what Shapira refers to as regime-serving songs, portraying a non-existent Israeli reality, songs depicting the digging up of wells and fields, songs of shepherds and of flocks, and all along sung to what sounds like German marches or Russian folk tunes. So what Shapira did in the fourth movement of his own piece, Akedah, was take a collection of 120 songs taken from the Israeli canon. Amongst these songs were Israeli folk songs, commercials from the early 80s, famous partisan songs, traditional army and war songs, holiday songs, religious songs, and so on. All of these materials played together, put together, some sung with their original lyrics, yet most appearing just in melody. And these melodies are played not with any electronic sound that could be considered remotely flattering, but rather with the worst synthetic sound known to man. This is, of course, General MIDI. If this setting of the materials doesn't manage to ridicule them enough, then Shapira also starts editing these incessantly repeating materials as the fourth movement reaches its end. Now, these same materials are being sped up, either through editing or electronic manipulation, and are swirled into the same delirium relating back to the Israeli folk dance tunes from the radio shows of the 70s and 80s. On a side note, I'd like to make a mention to the trademark Shapira editing that one can hear not only in this fourth movement of Akedah, but in many of Shapira's electronic and tape pieces. Shapira does not attempt in any way to fade in or out any edits made to the tape part. By doing so, he creates a dirty, almost offensive final product. The reasoning for this is beyond aesthetics. True, Shapira is more interested in dirty and incomplete sounds rather than those considered traditionally beautiful. But this way of editing also conceptualizes a point Shapira tries to make in many of his electronic and political pieces, and indeed here in the fourth movement of Akedah. The point being that the truth is not beautiful. The truth is in fact very dirty, incomplete, uncomfortable, and more than anything, not what we think it to be. His approach towards artists trying to beautify any aspect of their own art is that their art is no better than these regime-serving songs, which he tries to mock. Shapira goes on to criticize elements of the Israeli narrative in the fifth and last movement of Akedah, but this in an entirely different manner.
Thank you. rêver en les chutes fautes. Galéante de tout vide, Mashiach, Eros, pour Metzaref, Verina Chutzka, Bemota.
As you can tell, the final movement of Akedah is written in a rock style. It is in fact most reminiscent of a rock opera of sorts due to its orchestration. I personally could only wish that anything any rock opera composer or a Lloyd Webber out there ever wrote were even remotely as interesting. But hey, you know, there's always hope. Not for Lloyd Webber, maybe, but for the future of music. The soloist in this movement is a voice anyone in Israel should recognize, especially young girls, as this is the voice of Eran Tzur, a very famous Israeli rock and pop singer. Eran Tzur, coupled with a very compelling rock song, is singing a text made up exclusively of nouns. These are not any nouns, but nouns taken from speeches delivered by Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. The only full sentence used, repeated over and over again, is the sentence, "and if necessary, in the price of their death." Hebrew speakers amongst you who are familiar with different aspects of Israeli culture would easily notice how ridiculous this text sounds in the context within which it is performed. Ben-Gurion, by now himself a canonic figure, had originally intended to buoy up the popular spirits with such speeches, and give the avid Israeli listener a feeling of a mythical history in the making. Using only the nouns taken from these speeches makes the texts in Akedah sound quite ridiculous, and this because the nouns themselves have already, in some way, received a mythical character, yet, devoid of a normal sentence, these same nouns sound nothing more than absolutely ridiculous. So here are some of these nouns that Shapira refers to as quote-unquote standard Zionist cliches. Vision, redemption, kibbutz, tool, humanity, prophets, messiah, land, society, country, and the ongoing repetition of the one whole sentence, and if necessary, in the price of their death. In our conversation, Shapira had given me the reasoning for choosing a singer such as Eran Tzur for this movement, and indeed the reason for the setting of the whole movement in the style of a rock opera. And I quote, "Politicians are like rock stars. They must be loved at any cost." This metaphor, using rock stars, reminds me personally of something Shapira used to repeat many times in my ears when I was still his student. He used to ask me what I thought the difference between a rock composer and a classical composer is. Now, in his eyes, the difference was that a rock composer, usually a performer, stands on stage and is having a dialogue with the audience, in a way is constantly aware of the audience. Are they happy with the performance? Is this the time for a new song the audience might not know or like? Or should I play it safe with a hit? This is the psyche of a rock composer. A classical composer, on the other hand, Shapira would add, is in a constant monologue, always telling the audience, this is what you should be listening to, never bothering whether the audience is satisfied with the outcome or not. Now, Shapira, of course, used to make this little metaphor to actually exemplify to me how many classical composers act, in his eyes, like rock musicians. How many of them, whilst writing supposedly difficult or highbrow music, are still very concerned with how their audiences might react or feel towards their music. This, I think, is also a point that Shapira might be trying to make with the use of pseudo-rock music in the last movement of Akedah. It's as if he's saying, it isn't only that the politicians are trying to please the masses for their own psychological purposes, but rather, the decision that these same politicians make, the acts that they carry, are an immediate representation of their audiences, in fact, public's wishes. Akedah was premiered last summer in the Israeli music holidays. The soloists are soprano Tehila Nini Goldstein, mezzo-soprano Ayelet Amotz Abramson, contralto Bracha Kol, and the rock singer, Eran Tzur. The live electronics were performed by Guy Barash. The ensemble of various instrumentalists performing Akedah were Ensemble Meitar and Friends. All of these conducted by the young conductor, Karin Ben Yosef. A word should be said about the director of Ensemble Meitar, the Israeli pianist Amit Dolberg, who is slowly becoming one of the most prominent figures in the Israeli contemporary music scene. Dolberg was the man to almost single-handedly produce this production of Akedah, and deserves much credit not only for the performance I am about to play for you, our listeners, today, but for his efforts for Israeli contemporary music at large. Dolberg has managed to gather a cast predominantly made up of young musicians. Shapira said to me that he adores young musicians, and always rather work with young people as they are open-minded and open to change. So after many words, and soon to follow after our very catchy Chalas jingle, this is me, Ofir Olzetsky, leaving you until our next time on an hour with Sacrifice, Akedah, by the Israeli composer Ari Shapira.